Law self-defense content you are about to enjoy is presented for general educational purposes only. It does not constitute legal advice. If you are in need of legal advice, consult competent legal counsel in the relevant jurisdiction.
Hey folks, welcome to our ongoing coverage of the Minnesota murder trial of Derek Chauvin over the in-custody death of George Floyd. I'm attorney Andrew Branker for Law self-defense.
Today's content is sponsored by CCW Safe, a provider of legal service memberships, what many people mistakenly call self-defense insurance. CCW Safe, in effect, promises to pay their members' legal expenses if their member is involved in a use of force event, and those expenses start big and get bigger fast, folks. A typical aggravated assault charge, what can happen if you simply point your gun at another person in self-defense, don't fire a shot, don't hurt anybody, can risk a 10 or 20 year felony sentence and cost as much as $30,000 to $50,000 in legal fees to defend, and that's just for the pre-trial expense. If you don't have that kind of money stuffed in a mattress, just in case you're compelled to defend yourself or your family, it can be useful to have a financial partner standing behind you to make sure you have the legal resources you need to fight the legal battle the way you'd want it fought. Now, I've looked at all these types of services you might imagine, and I found that CCW Safe is the best fit for me. I'm a member. My wife, Emily, is a member. Whether they're the best fit for you is something only you can decide, but I do encourage you to take a look at what they have to offer by pointing your browser to lawofselfdefense.com/CCWSafe. And if you do decide to become a member of CCW Safe, you can save 10% off your membership at that URL, lawofselfdefense.com/CCWSafe, using the discount code LOSD10. That's LOSD for Law of Self-Defense and the number 10. I'll post a brief mention that tomorrow morning I'll be a guest, it looks like, on the Glenn Beck Show, airing at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. So if you're interested, I believe you'll be able to enjoy even more attorney Andrew Branca at glennbeck.com. That's Glenn with two N's at that time. Okay, so today we saw the closing arguments for the state delivered by prosecutor Steve Schlesher, the closing argument for the defense delivered by, of course, defense counsel Eric Nelson, and the rebuttal closing for the state delivered by prosecutor Jerry Blackwell. Prosecutor Schlesher's closing was pretty standard, although with the usual triple dose of emoting we've come to expect in politically energized prosecutions of this type, and perhaps really a double dose of even that due to Minnesota's unique provision for allowing spark of life evidence during the guilt phase of the trial. It's not unusual for states to allow such evidence in the sentencing phase once guilt has been determined. Very unusual to allow that kind of emotional, personalized life history evidence of purported victims of crimes in the guilt phase before guilt has been determined. To say that those portions of his closing were saccharine would be an understatement for sure. But that said, the bulk of Schlesher's closing was an incremental step-by-step look at the three counts the jury is to consider: second-degree felony murder, along with the predicate felony third-degree assault, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. Schlesher used a table with the individual counts on the x-axis and the elements along the horizontal to guide the jury in their analysis. And really, all of that is entirely reasonable. I may disagree substantively with the inferences that Schlesher chooses to suggest from the evidence, and it's unavoidable that he tends to mention only the evidence favorable to the state's theory of guilt. But that's all how the game is designed to be played. After all, there's a reason why the defense exists to do its own heavy lifting on convincing the jury that the state has failed to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. So I don't have that much to say about Schlesher's closing in this trial. It was pretty standard fare. I do have the video of that embedded in the text version of today's content. Then we had defense counsel Nelson's closing argument. And frankly, the closing argument was unusual mostly in its length. It was nearly three full hours, which is quite a long time. In fact, there was a half-hour break in lunch at about the two-and-a-half-hour mark, because by then it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Minnesota time, and the jury hadn't had lunch yet, and the judge hadn't had lunch yet. But frankly, I don't see how that much time could have been avoided. If you've seen my view of a likely narrative of innocence, or at least narrative of not guilty for the defense that we posted up yesterday on Sunday, it was also very lengthy. There are just a lot of issues circling this case that need to be addressed by the defense. And overall, I think Nelson did a very good job in hitting those key issues on closing. although he definitely seemed to tire by the end, and the 30-minute break for lunch mid-closing didn't seem to help his pacing any. Indeed, one place I felt Nelson very much fell short might have been solely a matter of running out of time and out of gas. And that is one of the more challenging portions of the entire timeline of Chauvin's restraint of Floyd, is that last 90 seconds between when Officer King states that he can't find a pulse and just about 1 minute, 30 seconds later when the paramedics arrive on scene and take over Floyd. Proponents of guilt routinely argue, with some merit, that even if Chauvin's restraint was justified up to the point of no pulse, surely it was no longer justified after that point. Now, there are definite arguments that can be made by the defense consistent with innocence on this point. Here are a couple of examples, not intending to be comprehensive, but just for illustrative purposes. First, just because King stated he couldn't find a pulse doesn't mean that Chauvin himself was actually aware of that condition. We can hear King say it on his body camera video, but Chauvin was positioned more around the corner of the vehicle, more visible to the crowd, which means he was much more exposed to the by then very angry, very loud crowd. And it's quite possible that Chauvin's attention was distracted by the apparent hostile intent of the crowd, and he was not actually aware of King's inability to find a pulse. He didn't hear him. Even if he would normally have heard him at that distance, he might not have heard him in those circumstances. Second, however, even if Chauvin was aware of King's finding of no apparent pulse, there was the apparent threat of the crowd itself. Chauvin had already had to display his OC spray once. An obviously angry MMA expert fighter, Williams, was stepping off the curb and advancing on the officers. And today in rebuttal, even Prosecutor Blackwell acknowledged that the crowd could easily have taken control of the scene from the officers, but for their respect for the badge. So even the state concedes that the threat from the crowd was at least potentially real, even though they also sometimes claim the opposite view, depending on how Blackwell's feeling in the moment. What matters, however, is not whether the state actually concedes the risk of the crowd, but whether there's evidence to support a reasonable officer in Chauvin's position having a reasonable fear of harm from the angry, hostile, and threatening crowd. And clearly, there is such evidence. Now, in this context of a hostile environment, you may recall that MPD medical training lead McKenzie, a state's witness and then recalled later as a defense witness, had testified that CPR should be stopped, or if not yet begun, then not started, if the scene became unsafe. That is, CPR should not be engaged in until the scene had been made secure. That was clearly not happening in those 90 seconds between no pulse and the paramedics arriving. A reasonable officer in Chauvin's position might well have concluded that the safety of himself, his partners, even a Floyd, were sufficiently in imminent harm that it would be imprudent to uncuff Floyd and attempt to begin CPR in the presence of a hostile crowd. This is especially so given that paramedics were expected momentarily and would have a securable vehicle inside which to treat Floyd. Now, reasonable people can disagree with either of those two rationales for why a reasonable officer in Chauvin's position might not have begun CPR on Floyd in the 90 seconds between King being unable to find a pulse and the paramedics arriving. That's not really my point, the merits of the arguments. Rather, my point is that Nelson didn't really make those arguments. He did mention several of the relevant factors, such as the angry, hostile, and threatening crowd, and that there was only 90 seconds between no pulse and paramedic arrival, but he didn't stitch those isolated facts into a coherent rationale, a narrative, for not immediately initiating CPR the moment King was unable to find a pulse. Now, the jury itself could piece those together, but that's not really how it's supposed to work. You're supposed to piece them together as the defense and hand a complete narrative to the jury for their consideration. You don't want them to have to work to come up with an acquittal. And as you might expect, that was a vulnerability eagerly exploited by Prosecutor Blackwell, who conducted the prosecutor's rebuttal. Before we get to that, for your viewing pleasure, and remember, it's just under 3 hours for this, I've embedded the video of Nelson's defense closing in the text version of today's content. Finally, we had Prosecutor Jerry Blackwell give the state rebuttal closing. So how this works is the state closes first, then the defense, then the state can rebut. And Prosecutor Blackwell's closing was, to this lawyer's eyes, where the dynamite was packed into this day, but not for good reasons for the state, mostly because it appears to me that Blackwell laid a pretty strong foundation for a defense claim of prosecutorial misconduct warranting a mistrial or a reversal of conviction in this case. Indeed, the defense made an oral motion for a mistrial on this basis, prosecutorial misconduct because of Blackwell's rebuttal close. And while Judge Cahill kind of hemmed and hawed about, well, I guess it wasn't really appropriate for Blackwell to do that, he ultimately responded, as he's done with every other defense motion for a mistrial, and denied the motion for a mistrial. Now, the basis for a claim of prosecutorial misconduct here is that Blackwell repeatedly suggested to the jury, basically, that the defense was outright lying. And a prosecutor is not allowed to make such arguments in closing in a criminal trial. Indeed, a prosecutor is far more constrained in making such suggestions about the defense than is the defense in making similar suggestions about the state. And this greater constraint reflects the greater apparent authority that a state prosecutor representing the government brings to the courtroom relative to a defense attorney merely representing a criminal defendant. It's worth recalling on this point also that Blackwell is not really a prosecutor in the normal course of his legal career. Rather, he's a professional civil litigator who was brought into this case on a pro bono basis as part of the politics around the prosecution. As a civil litigator, Blackwell would normally have very broad privilege to attack the credibility or even integrity of opposing counsel's arguments. A breath of privilege that, when applied in the context of acting as a prosecutor, can easily slide into misconduct sufficient to warrant a mistrial or reversal of conviction, even if that's the only cause for appeal, which obviously is not the case in this trial. To my eye, it looked as if Blackwell felt as if he were merely striking back at suggestions made by Nelson in his closing statement that the state was not being entirely truthful in its interpretation of the evidence in this case. It was as if, and obviously I'm doing a little speculating mind reading here, I don't know what Blackwell really thought, but it was as if Blackwell was somewhat outraged at what he might have felt was being labeled a liar by the defense, and he decided to give just as good right back. Unfortunately for Blackwell, just as the burden of proof in a civil trial is equally shared between the parties, it's a balanced preponderance of the evidence, but the burden of proof in a criminal trial is wildly and appropriately balanced against the state beyond a reasonable doubt. The degree to which the defense in a criminal trial can suggest less than complete honesty on the part of the state is wildly greater than the extent to which the state can do the same to the defense. Under Minnesota law, this issue of prosecutorial misconduct basically characterizing the defense in a derogatory way is governed by the Minnesota State Supreme Court decision, Estate v. McDaniel. That's 777 Northwest 2nd, 739, 2010 decision. It is hyperlinked in the text version of today's content, but it provides in relevant part, and I'm just going to quote it here, quote, "A prosecutor has special responsibilities as a representative of the people. Specifically, in final argument to the jury, a prosecutor is governed by a unique set of rules which differ significantly from those governing counsel in civil suits and even from those governing defense counsel in the very same criminal trial. These special rules follow directly from the prosecutor's inherently unique role in the criminal justice system, which mandates that the prosecutor not act as a zealous advocate for criminal punishment, but as the representative of the people in an effort to seek justice. Prosecutors must avoid inflaming the jury's passions and prejudices against defendants. Although a prosecutor can argue that a particular defense has no merit, a prosecutor may not belittle the defense, either in the abstract or by suggesting that the defense was raised because it was the only defense that might succeed." Close quote. And Blackwell sure engaged in his fair share of belittling the defense argument. While not calling defense counsel Nelson a liar to his face, he belittled the defense argument as a mere story. When corrected on that, a fabrication that, unlike reality, basically should not be given any credence. It's a lie. Even one such implication would be improper by a prosecutor, but it might be let slide by defense counsel. Two or three such implications are grounds for an objection. And Nelson did object at that point and had that objection upheld by Judge Cahill. But Blackhell simply would not stop at one or two or three of these implications. In all, he contemptuously belittled the defense argument as a mere story or fabrication roughly 20 times, and that is way over the line. Further, Blackwell falsely attributed arguments to the defense that they simply had not made, creating straw man arguments that, when presented by a state prosecutor, have the effect of calling out the defense as outright liars, although here it was the state doing the lying. Blackwell also falsely characterized the actual testimony of witnesses, claiming they said things they hadn't said, or purporting to paraphrase their testimony using different words that profoundly changed the apparent meaning and weight of that testimony. He also went so far as to suggest that reasonable inferences of the evidence made by the defense, I'm thinking specifically here that the defense argument that squad car 320 was running when Floyd was placed prone beside the vehicle, that was a statement made without evidence because there was no testimony from any witness that the vehicle was running. And that's true. There was no testimony from any witness that the vehicle was running. But that statement by the prosecutor Blackwell here could easily be understood to be a claim that the defense was wrongfully making claims of fact absent any evidence. In other words, that the defense was just making crap up. But in fact, it's perfectly fine for anyone to make reasonable inferences from available evidence. And Nelson explicitly inferred the vehicle was operating based on the body-worn camera showing the driver never reached for the keys to turn off the vehicle once he pulled up at Cub Foods. He put it in gear and jumped out of the car. That's a reasonable inference to make, that the car was still running because it had never apparently been turned off. Now, really, this entire manner of argument by Blackwell struck me as one made by a person who, frankly, didn't believe the merits would carry them to beyond a reasonable doubt, and thus was compelled to resort to his own fabrication and ad hominem attacks in an effort to win, and both of which are conduct in which perhaps other attorneys might engage without difficulty or problem, but it's conduct which is prohibited for prosecutors. So, of course, Blackwell's rebuttal is also embedded for your viewing pleasure in the text version of today's content. Oh, I've also embedded the brief motion for a mistrial by Nelson, made by Nelson, based on prosecutorial misconduct and the denial of that motion by Judge Cahill. This was all done orally in the courtroom, so the video of that is also embedded in the text version of today's content. Now, the final thing I want to talk about was another interesting bump in the road. An ambiguity on the legal doctrine of causation that was not resolved today. And I think that's a real problem for this case, at least for deliberations. And perhaps the most interesting thing about it is not so much that this issue came up, but that it was left until so late in the day. And it's a profound disagreement between the state and the defense on the question of the legal doctrine of causation as it applies to the facts and law of this case. And what's most surprising, again, is not that the parties disagree on this issue. That hardly seems avoidable given the complex, multifactorial facts at play here, but that the disagreement only became concretely apparent, manifest, after the defense had presented its closing argument. I would have expected this to be resolved during the charge conference last Thursday or Friday while the jury instructions were being finalized. So what's the issue here? The crux of the issue is that Chauvin is criminally liable for Floyd's death only if his conduct was a substantial cause of that death. That's the causation issue. And if it was a substantial cause, then it need not be the only cause in order for criminal liability to attach. And that's important because in theory, there's lots of causes of Floyd's death, right? So do you need to be able to exclude them all except for Chauvin's conduct? Or do you not need to exclude them all because it only matters if Chauvin's conduct was one of many that would be sufficient for criminal liability to attach? So it may sound like a simple question, but it's not on the facts of this case. In a typical criminal offense scenario, the question of causation tends to be pretty straightforward. Now, imagine this hypothetical. there's a robber, and he's armed with a tire iron, and he steps out of her doorway. He confronts the victim, "Give me your money or suffer grave injury." And in response, the victim jumps backwards to move out of reach of the tire iron. Unfortunately for the victim, when he jumps backwards, he leaps off the curb into the street and is promptly run over and killed by a city bus. Did that robber cause the death of the victim? Did the robber kill the victim? Well, not, he didn't kill him directly. After all, the robber never even touched the victim. But the victim would never have simply jumped backwards and into the path of the bus unless he had been prompted to do so by the robber's threat. In that sense, the robber's threat was a substantial cause of the victim's death. Now let's imagine a different scenario. Now we have not a robber, but a nun. A nun seeking donations for the local orphanage, and she steps out of the church doorway to make a request for a donation of a pedestrian coming down the street. And the pedestrian's looking at a smartphone while he's walking, so he's startled by the sudden appearance of the nun. And unknown to either the nun or the pedestrian has a genetic predisposition to cerebral strokes that can be triggered by surprise. And sure enough, startled by the nun, the pedestrian suffers a fatal stroke and dies there on the sidewalk. Did the nun kill the victim? Did the nun cause the victim's death? Well, not directly, for sure, but was she a substantial cause of his death? Nevertheless, after all, but for the nun startling the pedestrian would still be alive. He didn't die a block earlier or a block later. He died right there when he was startled by the nun. The difference between those two scenarios, of course, is that in the case of the robber and the victim, the robber was the sole cause of the reaction of the victim jumping into the path of the bus. But in the case of the nun and the pedestrian brought his unique vulnerability, the unknown predisposition to stroke, with him. In the case of the in-custody death of Floyd, the defense position is that Floyd is akin to the nun-pedestrian scenario rather than the robber-victim scenario. That is, Floyd did not die as a result of a downstream event that occurred because of Chauvin's restraint, which in the defense view would not have caused the death of an otherwise healthy suspect subject to the same restraint, but rather Floyd died in the defense view. Floyd died because of the combination of his extremely vulnerable physiology with his unfortunate toxicology, both of which were not caused by Chauvin, but which Floyd brought to the event with him. In that view, if Floyd was actually killed by his physiology and toxicology, then he was not killed in a substantially causal way by Chauvin's restraint. And therefore, if that's your view, to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it was Chauvin's restraint that killed Floyd, the state is first obliged to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt that Floyd was killed by his physiology or toxicology. And if they fail to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt that Floyd was killed by his physiology or toxicology, then Chauvin is not legally liable for Floyd's death. Again, to be clear, that's the defense view of how the doctrine of substantial causation should apply to the facts of the Floyd case. And that's what Nelson told the jury during his closing argument. Unless the state disproves beyond a reasonable doubt that Floyd was killed by his physiology, his cardiovascular disease, his hypertension, his enlarged heart, his paraganglioma, unfortunate fentanyl and meth toxicity, unless the state disproves all those as causes of death, you must find Chauvin not guilty. Well, as you might imagine, the state view is quite different. The state does not draw this distinction between these alternative causes of death that were a direct result of Chauvin's restraint, or at least downstream of Chauvin's restraint on the one hand, which arguably the defense would agree would be substantial causes of death. Those on the one hand, and alternative causes of death that Floyd might have brought with him to the event, which the defense would argue would, unless those are eliminated, you don't have a substantial cause of death because those could have killed Floyd. In the state's view, it doesn't matter where those alternative causes of death might have come from. They need not disprove any of them to any particular degree of certainty, just so long as they can show that among the whole bucket of possible causes of death, they have proven that Chauvin's conduct was at least a substantial cause of death, and that they've proven that beyond a reasonable doubt. In that view, the state has no obligation to first disprove beyond a reasonable doubt that all the other alternative causes of death that Floyd brought with him, his heart disease, his hypertension, his paraganglioma, his toxicology. They don't need to disprove those first beyond a reasonable doubt before Nelson can be found. Now, as you might expect, if that's the state's view, they objected to Nelson suggesting to the jury that they did have that obligation to disprove all those other things as a cause of death and to do so beyond a reasonable doubt. And they raised that objection to Judge Cahill after Nelson's close. Again, awkward timing. I would have expected this to be resolved during the charge conference over the defining the final form of the jury instructions. Because obviously, this matter of legal doctrine matters a great deal. Does the state have the burden of disproving physiology and toxicology as a cause of death, and to do so beyond a reasonable doubt? If they do, acquittal, at least on the merits of the case, would seem certain. On the other hand, if they do not have to disprove those things, if it's enough that Chauvin's conduct was a substantial cause, regardless of what Floyd brought with him to the event, well, then conviction seems much more likely, especially given the defense, frankly, kind of collapse of their expert use of force witness. It's a distinction with a difference, folks. It really matters. And that brings us to perhaps the most remarkable portion of this dispute today, and that is that Judge Cahill effectively did nothing to clarify which view of the law of substantive causation was correct. The state offered a clarifying jury instruction that naturally favored the state and the defense didn't like, and the judge decided to basically do nothing to further guide the jury on this point, except to reread the jury instruction, reread to the jury the general instruction on causation. But guess what, folks? The general jury instruction on causation does nothing whatever to clarify this issue, because it's really more geared towards the more traditional robber-victim scenario that I described above than it is to the much more complex fact pattern of the Chauvin-Floyd encounter. In particular, the instruction speaks to the consequences of the defendant's actions, but Floyd's existing cardiovascular disease, pathological high blood pressure, enlarged heart, tumor, fentanyl, meth toxicity, those are not consequences of Chauvin's restraint of Floyd. Floyd brought those to the event with him. So if those are what killed him, they're not really addressed by this jury instruction. So just for your information, the relevant part of the jury instruction reads, quote, "To cause death, causing death, or caused death means that the defendant's act or acts were a substantial causal factor in causing the death of George Floyd. The defense is criminally liable for all the consequences of his actions that occur in the ordinary and natural course of events, including those consequences brought about by one or more intervening causes, if such intervening causes were the natural result of the defendant's acts. The fact that other causes contribute to the death does not relieve the defendant of criminal liability." Close quote. Well, I think you could see how that definition of causality could fit either the prosecution or defense view on this issue. Now, I'm afraid that I have a strong suspicion that the reason that the judge didn't clarify that causation should be understood as claimed by the state on the one hand or as claimed by the defense on the other is that the judge himself doesn't know. And the judge may not know because it appears to me on a cursory review that the Minnesota appellate courts have not clearly distinguished between these two views of substantial causation. Virtually every appellate case I could find in the brief time I had available, admittedly, and by the way, most of those were civil cases. They were almost all civil cases, civil litigation, not criminal cases. But they were almost all of the more traditional robber victim type, in which the substantial cause was entirely the consequence of the robber's action, and not a scenario in which the victim of the bad outcome had brought their unique vulnerability with them. So ultimately, this might be an issue of first impression for the Minnesota appellate courts, at least in this unusual context. In the meantime, however, I have no idea how the jury is expected to know how to specifically apply this legal doctrine of substantial causality to the facts of this case. If even the lawyers and the judge don't know, must the prosecution have disproved Floyd's physiology and toxicology as causes of death beyond a reasonable doubt in order for the jury to find Chauvin guilty, as the defense has argued, or is it merely enough that they find Chauvin's conduct substantially caused Floyd's death, regardless of the exceptionally vulnerable physiology and toxicology that Floyd brought with him, as the state argues. I confess I don't know. I expect the jury doesn't know either, and certainly the court itself was of zero help on this question. So that should make for interesting deliberations. If there's not a question on this issue from the jury, I'll be both surprised and terribly disappointed. Okay, folks, that's all I have for all of you today. We do have a verdict watch post up for review, I believe, and so I urge you to keep your eyes on that for breaking news. If the deliberations do drag out, I imagine I'll come up with something to write about the issues in the case each day or so, if that's of interest. Before I go, in view of the ongoing riots raging presently in Minneapolis, and I hope not, but possibly coming to a neighborhood near you soon, I've also taken the liberty of putting together a special opportunity to access our best-selling course, Lawful Defense Against Rioters, Looters, and Arsonists, available as a video course in both online, streamed, and DVD formats, your choice, or both. You can learn more about that course by pointing your browser to lawofselfdefense.com/riot. Okay, and before I really go, thanks as always to both Legal Insurrection and CCWC for the support that makes my coverage of this case possible. All right, folks, until next time, I remain Attorney Andrew Branker for Law of Self-Defense. Stay safe.